Wall Street in reverse. With words like tectonic shift, convulsion, and worst since the Great Depression, investment banks Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch prepare to go under or go away. Markets brace for an asteroid's direct hit. When bulls are as extinct as dinosaurs, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, September 15th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
And you are certainly right. Wall Street is waking up to perhaps a new world today, responding to massive shakeups over the weekend at Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch. Also, hundreds have been rescued in the aftermath of Hurricane Ike, and 2 million people are still without power. This week, Israel prepares for an important election and harnessing the power of a crowd to predict and prevent violence. We'll take a look. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
Embattled investment giant Lehman Brothers announced just this morning that it's headed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and Wall Street is bracing for the fallout. News of the collapse of one of the country's biggest investment banks sent pre-market numbers through the floor. European markets are down more than 4%. It looks like Merrill Lynch will be spared a similar fate, at least to Lehman Brothers. Bank of America says it's buying the world's biggest brokerage company in a $50 billion all-stock takeover. No rejoicing on Wall Street, though. AIG, the biggest insurance company in the world, is also in trouble. It's looking for $40 billion of emergency funding.
Today, more than a million Texans don't have power in the wake of Hurricane Ike. Galveston and Houston got pummeled. Texas Governor Rick Perry said it's going to take a long time to recover.
Hurricane Ike threw us a hard punch, but didn't dent our spirit. And Texans will be back. Galveston Island will be back better than ever.
Ike left a swath of destruction from Texas to Ohio. The storm dumped devastating rain on the Midwest, forcing evacuations and rescues. Ike is blamed for 30 deaths so far. An historic day in Zimbabwe. Just hours ago, President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai signed an historic power-sharing deal. Tsvangirai will be the new prime minister. He says he signed the deal because it's the country's best hope to end years of disastrous political and economic chaos.
I have signed this agreement because my belief in Zimbabwe and its peoples runs deeper than the scars I bear from the struggle.
Mugabe holds on to the presidency under the agreement. More details to come on that.
And the Associated Press is reporting that angry rivals from the deal are bearing down on the place where the agreement was signed. So unrest, at least in the wake of that historic signing. In politics, Barack Obama's on Good Morning America and then heads to Colorado. John McCain is campaigning in Florida today. Oil prices are well below $96 a barrel, and the rest of the market news is pointing very, very much lower. The S&P begins today at 1251, but it may open actually around 1200 based on the futures. So at 877-8-MY-TAKE, you can join the conversation. When a bailout is appropriate and when it is not, that's what we're talking about. Also, how do you get your children to eat challenging foods? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
We were talking about tricks that parents use or good strategies for getting your kids to eat healthy.
Or
it's
ones that your parents
you
used
think.
With you,
yeah,
actually.
That's great.
Ones your parents used. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We'll start on Wall Street, where it's a long list of malaise. Let's begin with Lehman Brothers. It announced its bankruptcy this morning, and that's the fourth largest investment firm in the United States is now bankrupt. Bank of America is buying the largest brokerage house in the United States, Merrill Lynch, for $50 billion. That was unexpected and happened over the weekend. Finally, the Federal Reserve has changed its approach to lending money to deal with this emergency. Oil is down almost $6 a barrel. And for a reaction on the markets in Europe and London, which are all down roughly 3 to 5%, we are joined by Jeremy Batstone Carr, who's an analyst with Charles Stanley Stockbrokers in London. Jeremy, thanks for joining us.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, we're not open here in Wall Street yet, but, you know, it's pretty ugly, and you've already experienced some fallout from the Lehman Brothers decision over in Europe. Run down what's going on in the markets there.
Yes, the ugly is the right word for it. I mean, it's orderly, but it is nonetheless cathartic. We're seeing 4.6% off the benchmark FTSE 100 as we speak. We're seeing about 4% off the DAX in Germany and about the same off the CAC in France. Quite clearly, financial stocks across the European markets are in the eye of the storm and are taking the most severe battering. A number of banks in the UK are down by more than 10%. Halifax Bank of Scotland, a large bank in this country, is down by 20% or more.
Jeremy, is the fact that this seems to be focused on the financial sector a positive for the manufacturing sector in the sense that the economy where most of consumers in the world live is actually still pretty healthy, or would that be a wrong conclusion to draw?
I think it's a wrong conclusion, I'm afraid. And the reason why Lehman's collapse and Merrill's takeover really matters is because this crisis, although it has its roots in the residential property market, is also a function of the fact that the funding markets have seized up. Now, the funding markets are important because that is where companies go to borrow money to finance their working capital and their capital expenditure, the money to grow, if you like. If they can't do that, then Main Street has got as much of a problem as Wall Street.
Well, Main Street is probably happy with the fact that oil is now well under $100 a barrel. 95.68 is what it's trading at right now. But is that a part of the global slowdown story as much as it is maybe a positive inflation number?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the lower oil price, and it is markedly lower today, it will come as good news because, of course, it's a major cost for many companies. But, of course, on the other hand, you've got the dollar problem. The dollar has recovered its poise on the foreign exchanges significantly. For those U.S.-based companies that trade considerably in overseas currencies, then the dollar strength will lead to negative translation effects. So, you know, what you gain on the swings in terms of the oil price, you lose on the roundabouts in terms of a higher dollar.
All right. Well, I asked you about the consumers broadly, and you didn't have much positive to say there. Let's go from the other end to the other end of the spectrum. Let's what's a Warren Buffett, a big trader, to do today? I mean, is he sort of sitting there greedily picking up bargains as this debacle makes its way across Wall Street, or does he even have some problems?
What Warren Buffett should be doing, and I think it's incumbent on all leaders in the financial industry, is to put pressure on governments, not just the U.S. government, but the European administrations, the U.K. and the Asian authorities as well. This is a global problem. It requires a global solution. Forget moral hazard. What has got to happen is that a publicly funded vehicle has got to be created into which distressed financial assets have got to be sunk. Forget the moral hazard. Basically, confidence in the global financial system has got to be restored. We are talking about something as fundamental as that. Without it, so help all of us.
But the suggestion there is a kind of a United Nations financial peacekeeping fund, right? That's right?
It's a radical step. I quite agree. But look, the problem is that people want to draw a line in the sand now. They're saying, you know, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, AIG, perhaps we can say that the worst is now over. The problem is that while the authorities continue to address this major bloodletting by simply attempting to stick a sticking plaster over it, we have got to see worse until the authorities wake up to the seriousness of the crisis.
Well, it's a spectacular and, you know, slightly chilling analysis there. Jeremy Batstone Carr is an analyst with Charles Stanley Stockbrokers in London. He joined us from London, where the markets are down 4 to 4.6%. Let's just review the bidding for a moment. Bank of America has bought Merrill Lynch for $50 billion. At least that's the deal on the table. Lehman Brothers is now technically bankrupt. They will file for bankruptcy, it appears, this week, if not today. And AIG, the insurance giant, if it doesn't get $40 billion in bailout money today, will begin to take a drawdown in its asset portfolio, and we could be looking at the same crisis tomorrow. That's the latest from Wall Street. You got any positive news, Adora?
No, not really. Actually, we're going to move to Texas, where we're going to talk about the aftermath of Hurricane Ike. It's the state there is in the midst of the largest rescue operation ever. Nearly 2,000 people have been rescued from flooded neighborhoods, and at least 2 million people have been without power for days, and potentially could be many more days before they get any electricity going there. Officials report at least 28 are dead. James McKinley is following the story from Houston for our partners, the New York Times. Good morning, James, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Can you tell us the status of rescue efforts at this point? Do officials feel like they've gotten everyone that needs help?
Well, the officials are very, very optimistic that they're going to get everybody out, but there are still some places along the coast that reporters have not gotten to, and we don't really know what we'll find when we get to those places.
And when you say that particularly, where do you mean specifically?
Well, there's a spit of land called Bolivar Peninsula, which is just it's an island on the other side of the mouth of Galveston Bay from Galveston Island, where we have had journalists. And Bolivar was hit extremely hard by the storm because the storm went right up the mouth of the bay. And they rescued about 96 people, 93 people, I believe, just before the storm hit. And rescue workers knew that there were at least 100, maybe 200 others that had been left behind. And so far, we have not been able to get to Bolivar Bay to find out what happened to those people. Some of them have been rescued, but there are unconfirmed reports that others may not have made it.
Now, initially, it seemed there was a minor sigh of relief that perhaps Ike could have been far worse than it actually was. But in the aftermath, it seems like we're finding out that the destruction was quite widespread and has caused a tremendous amount of damage, not to mention the fact that anywhere between 2 and 5 million people are without electricity at this point. There seems to be a lot of discrepancies on the reports as to how many people don't have electricity.
Well, there are a lot of people without electricity. The city alone, the city of Houston, which is about 2 million people, and then there are 4 million people in the greater Houston area. When you talk about that 4 million people, something like 76% are still without power as of now. And CenterPoint Energy and Entergy, which is a company over in Louisiana, are working hard to get that power back up. But they're talking about weeks before power is completely restored. So that's an enormous problem, especially since Houston is a hub of activity for refining. And you can't run a refinery without electricity. So this could have an enormous effect across the country on the cost of gasoline. By some estimates, a quarter of the nation's production capacity has been knocked out.
James McKinley, thanks very much. He reports for our partners, the New York Times, and he was coming to us from Houston there. And we should note that actually oil is trading at this morning at $96 a barrel.
Yeah, so the loss of production down there is having virtually no impact on the oil markets. We're covering all of the markets this morning. If you want to listen to The Takeaway, we are online at thetakeaway.org all morning long, so you can get continual updates between now and when the markets open and then afterwards. Also, we're talking about like strategies, you know, something a little more micro than the macro markets and the issues of climate change and hurricanes. If you want a strategy for getting your kids to eat healthy foods, what works in your household? What didn't work when you were growing up? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Should we just leave kids alone to eat what they want? And also the question of a bailout.
A bailout. When should someone or something be bailed out? We saw Bear Stearns. The feds bailed them out. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac got bailed out. Lehman Brothers not bailed out by the feds. Is that a good idea, a bad idea? When have you not been bailed out and failure was actually a good thing? Tell us your story, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You know, we've been talking about this moral hazard business. It's the question of when you allow something to fail and when you don't. That's the issue on our minds, along with eating healthy food right here on The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. As we observe the historic unraveling that seems to be taking place on Wall Street, it's worthwhile to take a look at another bit of history, like mid-June 2006, when President Bush made a surprise trip to Iraq.
But the American people have got to understand, I believe we're going to succeed. That's why we're there. And my message to the Iraqis is we're going to help you succeed. My message to the enemy is don't count on us leaving before we succeed. My message to our troops is we support you 100%. Keep doing what you're doing. And my message to the critics is that we listen very carefully and adjust when needed to adjust.
That's President Bush speaking in the White House Rose Garden after he returned from Iraq. And even at that moment, he was already starting to believe that the policy in Iraq was unraveling. It's something he told to reporter Bob Woodward, the author of The War Within, which is the latest volume in what has turned out to be a four-volume epic of the Bush administration during a time of war. Bob Woodward joins us. He's assistant managing editor at The Washington Post. Bob, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
First of all, you know, one of the main sort of policy headlines that comes out of your book, and I wonder if you'd elaborate on it, if you would, is that the surge in hindsight, from your perspective, and your perspective is very much inside the administration during a lot of these meetings that were going on, even in 2006, the surge turns out to be less important than maybe it's being heralded during the campaign. Explain.
Well, it's not the silver bullet, but there were other things going on in Iraq. The Sunni awakening, where former insurgents joined up with the United States to fight al-Qaeda. But as I report, there were secret operations which can't be talked about in detail. And the White House acknowledged this about 10 days ago after the book came out, newly developed techniques and operations that allowed U.S. troops in a very significant and lethal way to identify, target, and kill key leaders in al-Qaeda and members of the insurgency.
Let's talk about the president for a moment. I mean, if we take all four of your books together, one of the themes of President Bush's style as a leader is that he really values this sort of face-to-face, person-to-person communication, and that was indeed the case with President Maliki of Iraq. Yet, you report in the book that when push comes to shove, he really doesn't trust Maliki and actually spent a good deal of time spying on him. Explain.
Yes. Well, this is one of the things that happens in the intelligence community. They have a great capacity to get information. As I quote somebody saying, we know everything he says, namely the Prime Minister of Iraq, Mr. Maliki. A lot of people said to me it's not clear this is that helpful to Bush, but what it does is it shifts the focus to what the Iraqis are doing and gets us off our eye off the ball of what we're doing. And one of the themes in all of these books, the last three really focusing on the Iraq War, is it took the president 4 years to wake up and realize that he had to change strategy and add more troops. And 4 years in a war of this magnitude is indeed
huge.
A long time.
Well, you know, this is a very compelling and I have to say very sad book about what's gone on behind the scenes in the Bush administration. And I wonder if we could just expand outward. I mean, you of course, began your reporting career with Watergate and covered Nixon and Kissinger. You know, in those administrations, you find characters who are masters of the policy and masters of the world in which they live. It seems, in looking at all four of your books about the Bush administration, that there are very few masters here, that a lot of people are just hanging around waiting for reports and looking at PowerPoint discussions. This is an administration which doesn't have a kind of wizard or master at the center, just a lot of people waiting for reports to be delivered. That's my impression. Am I wrong?
Well, no, it's an interesting one. Lots of historians would argue with you vehemently that Nixon or Kissinger were masters. I mean, they played power politics. But yes, there is a certain wandering, aimless quality to all of this over 4 years. And what it shows, I mean, it's not just a history of what happened in the last 2 years in Iraq and inside the White House with this kind of intimacy, that meeting, this document, and so forth. It's in many ways a roadmap to the issues that the next commander-in-chief, whether it's Obama or McCain, are going to face when they become president. I would venture to guess, and I think this is more than a guess, the first months of the new administration are going to be spent on Iraq. We have a massive land army in the middle of the Middle East. And in the reporting on this, you can see that there's certain problems that emerged. I mean, just for instance, what is the commander-in-chief's relationship, the president's relationship with the generals? In the case of Bush, he never got it right. He never, maybe until Petraeus.
Very late in the game. Let me just push you here, sure. Bob, on one point. You don't normally go into this territory, but I'm going to push you here. What quality of leadership? And you've been observing the Bush administration for the last 7 years. What quality of leadership do you think is absolutely essential for whoever is president January 09 to begin to turn this around?
It's a great question. They've got to understand this kind of war. I mean, a lot of the generals felt that the president always looked at it almost as a conventional war, always wanting body counts. It's a very complicated war. I think the thing the new president is going to have to do is figure out, which again is something Bush never really got his arms around, how you're going to get conflicting data. In the case of Bush, the generals were saying one thing, the National Security Council staff was saying another. And you have to resolve that data. You have to dig beneath the contradictions and figure out in your own mind what's really going on.
Before reality just like overwhelms you, which is certainly the portrait that you create in the book. Well, we got to go now, but Bob, thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Bob Woodward, author of The War Within. Of course, he's the assistant managing editor at The Washington Post. And now, quick headlines from Femi. Okay.
Thanks, John. The market's open just over an hour from now. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. It looks like it's going to be an interesting day on Wall Street. Lehman Brothers says it's filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. That sent futures plummeting. But Merrill Lynch is getting a boost from Bank of America. It's buying Merrill for $50 billion. AIG, the insurance giant, could use some help. It's looking for $40 billion in emergency loans. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in Baghdad today. He's meeting with military leaders there. And Gates says that U.S. forces will be stepping into the background in Iraq. That's a quick look at your main headlines for this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, which asks, is there an age when people should no longer be held accountable for their actions? Can someone be too old to be responsible? Or is that ageism? Opinions shared at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Monday, September 15th. Well, the political turmoil of the summer in Israel may be coming to an end this week. The country's ruling party, Kadima, will hold elections on Wednesday to select a new leader in the aftermath of controversy and corruption charges facing Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, along with sharp criticism of his handling of the 2006 war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. The new Kadima leader could become the new prime minister if he or she is successful at building a new coalition government, and it could be a she for the first time in 30 years. Ethan Bronner is the Jerusalem bureau chief for our partner, the New York Times, and he joins us. Ethan, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Adora.
So tell us a little bit about the Israeli foreign minister who seems to be leading the polls among the Kadima voters.
Yes, Tzipi Livni is her name. She is a relatively new face in Israeli politics, meaning that she is not a career politician. She was a lawyer, a practicing lawyer for most of her life, and was recruited about 10 years ago to the Likud party, largely by Ariel Sharon, the then prime minister. And, you know, like Sharon and like the current prime minister, Ehud Olmert, Livni sort of followed a rather interesting arc, a political voyage from the right to the center to center left, depending on how you want to define it, so that she has been leading one of the important set of negotiations with the Palestinians for a two-state solution, and she is firmly devoted to the concept of two states for two people, where she was brought up in a family deep within right-wing revisionism, Zionism. Her parents were both fighters, underground fighters on the right of the Zionist underground, that, you know, whose slogan was both sides of the Jordan River, so the sort of greater land of Israel concept. So it's been she's an interesting lady.
And in an interesting party, Kadima, formed by former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who's been in a coma since 2006. What kind of shape is the party in at the moment?
Well, that's a really good question. It is likely to form the next government. That is either Ms. Livni or her main rival, Shaul Mufaz, who's the transport minister and a former chief of staff and defense minister. One of them will win. She is leading the polls, but
by double digits. I mean, she's actually leading the
poll. Well, some of them are double digits. There's one poll that shows her only 5% ahead. There are only about 60 to 70,000 voters involved. People are unclear about whether there's been some shady practices in voter registration for the party. Really, no one is too sure. It seems likely that she will win, but it's not certain. In any case, the party is, you know, it's unusual in Israel because it's got a kind of neither milk nor meat quality to it, speaking in kosher terms, if you like. It's a sort of middle of the road. Some people have criticized it and them for being more like sort of shopkeepers or people without clear vision. I'm not endorsing that view, but there is a sense that it's a sort of in the middle rather than a great leader in terms of a vision. And this is a society that has existed on fairly strong visions over the years. So it's hard to know what its long-term viability is.
So exactly in the context of taking on the Likud party and Benjamin Netanyahu, where does that put Kadima relative to what Israelis in general are thinking?
Well, it seems that if there were a normal general election tomorrow, Kadima would lose to Netanyahu and the Likud. But the plan of both Mufaz and Livni is to, whoever wins will then try to form a coalition government. And there's fairly decent chance that he or she could do so, bringing in some of the smaller parties as well as the Labor Party. So if that happens, there is not a call for a new election until 2010. And then conceivably, if there is some kind of an agreement with the Palestinians and or with the Syrians, that's another track that's going on, that might bring along the people to a more centrist position and squeeze out Likud. But, of course, who knows?
Quickly, Ethan, how much of this is a waiting game for the new presidency in the United States, which, you know, depending on McCain or Obama, could be a fairly significant contrast for what happens going forward for Israel?
I don't really really know. I mean, I'm a little more skeptical than your question suggests that it would make a very big difference to those negotiations whether Obama or McCain wins. I think that both have shown a great devotion to Israel. I find it hard to believe that Obama would put really serious pressure on Israel to yield in ways that McCain wouldn't. I think the difference between them, and that would have a big impact here, has more to do with how aggressive they might feel toward Iran and its nuclearization. But it seems to me unlikely that in terms of negotiations with the Palestinians, it would make a huge difference. That doesn't mean there isn't a waiting game, because we are in a kind of lame duck situation all around. But I don't know that it's going to make a very big difference whoever wins.
Lame duck all around. That would be here in the U.S. as well as in Israel. Thanks. Ethan Brauner reports for a partner of the New York Times. He's the Jerusalem bureau chief. And now we're going to turn to the chief of our news here at The Takeaway, Femi Okeh. Femi?
I've been promoted. That's excellent. Thank you very much. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. Wall Street is still reeling after a frenetic weekend that upended some of the nation's biggest companies. Investment bank Lehman Brothers is filing for bankruptcy protection a week after its stocks took a steep dive. And Merrill Lynch is selling itself to Bank of America for about $50 billion. Meanwhile, insurance company American International Group is trying to keep its head above water by asking the Fed for around $40 billion in emergency loans. Hurricane Ike has left scenes of devastation across Texas. In the city of Galveston, relief workers are using boats, high-wheel trucks and helicopters to rescue hundreds of people trapped by flooding. Residents are stunned by the level of damage and flooding Ike has caused.
I've been living here for 26 years, and this is the first time I've never been able to get home. I've been trying to get home for 3 days.
President Bush visits the area tomorrow. He says that restoring power to everyone is a high priority, although in some places that could take as long as a month. A report by the UN Atomic Agency says that Iran is still blocking attempts to investigate allegations that it carried out research and experiments linked to a nuclear weapons program. The IAEA also says that Tehran is continuing to expand its capabilities to enrich uranium. Iran is under three sets of UN sanctions. Officials in Pakistan's tribal area of South Waziristan say that Pakistani troops had fired warning shots to repel an attempted border incursion by US troops. Pakistan's military confirmed that an incident took place, but denied their soldiers had fired at the Americans. There's growing tension between Pakistan and the US over cross-border raids by US-led forces who are targeting Taliban and Al-Qaeda insurgents. And finally, the man who invented the World Wide Web, not Al Gore, but Professor Tim Berners-Lee, he said that he's very concerned about rumors spreading on the internet and the fact that there's unscientific information out there.
Rumors on the web, hold
yes.
The presses. This just in, thank you, Femi Okeh.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And with oil trading roughly near $96 a barrel, we thought we would take a look at one nation who's watching the price of oil very, very closely. Joining us now is Patrick Duddy, who's the United States ambassador to Venezuela, who last week was called by President Chavez to go to hell 100 times as part of the move to actually expel him from the country or tell him to leave the country. Patrick Duddy, thanks, first of all, for joining us. You're in Washington, right?
That's correct.
Now, as comical as it sometimes seems, the behavior of President Hugo Chavez is, and the level of sort of tit-for-tat kinds of developments that are taking place in the relationship between Venezuela and the United States and also Venezuela's neighbors, how important is this declining price of oil to the political stability in Venezuela, do you think?
Well, and John, first of all, good morning, and good morning to your listeners. In the first instance, oil is petroleum is Venezuela's principal source of foreign exchange, and the United States is Venezuela's principal trading partner. We buy something over 50% of all of the oil they produce.
So how do we evaluate news stories like, for instance, these over-the-weekend military exercises simulating a mock invasion using Russian-made fighter jets and all of that?
Well, in the first instance, it's clear that Venezuela and the Venezuelan government is dealing with a range of issues and internal challenges and problems, ranging from substantial problems with crime, drug trafficking, the highest inflation in the hemisphere, et cetera. Venezuela has courted new and different foreign partners.
Like Bolivia, for instance. Bolivia, the story in Bolivia last week.
Yeah, Bolivia is an interesting story, and there is a close relationship between President Morales and President Chavez. But insofar as the Russians are concerned, you know, we don't see their presence there, particularly two aircraft, as a threat. No one has any particular doubt about who holds the preponderance of military force in the region and in the Caribbean basin. Our focus is more on the kinds of problems that we think we should work on with the Venezuelan people, problems like violence, like drug trafficking, which polling shows are also the highest priorities for the Venezuelan people.
Well, Ambassador, how do you answer the charge that the U.S. administration sometimes raises the profile of Hugo Chavez by paying way perhaps too much attention to a lot of these symbolic saber rattlings out of Caracas?
I think that particularly in recent months, the last couple of years, that's exactly wrong. We in fact, have not, I think, exaggerated the significance of those moves. He, on the other hand, has, to some degree, tried to cast himself as the protagonist in a conflict which, in our sense, no one really is, no one wants to see in the hemisphere.
Well, certainly the latest episode of that you're in the middle of. Patrick Duffy. Duddy is the United States ambassador to Venezuela. He spoke with us by phone after having been forced to leave Caracas. Thank you, Ambassador.
You're very welcome.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. On this Monday, September 15th, we have some headlines for you. Femi Aoki has just joined us. Femi?
Thank you very much. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Today, all eyes are on Wall Street, where developments over the last 48 hours have shaken the financial world. Lehman Brothers Bank is filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, while Bank of America is snapping up Merrill Lynch in a $50 billion all-stock transaction. American International Group, Inc. is also restructuring, and a global consortium of banks working with government officials in New York announced a $70 billion pool of funds to lend to troubled financial companies. Cleanup continues today in the wake of Hurricane Ike. The storm slammed into Texas, cutting power across the central U.S. More than 2 million people remain without power. Indiana and Chicago are also facing severe flooding. Hurricane Ike didn't do widespread damage to oil facilities in the Gulf of Mexico, and the price of oil has dipped again today. It's dropped below $96 a barrel in trading in Singapore. 12 civilians have been killed by car bombs today in Baghdad, as Defense Secretary Robert Gates arrived in the country for talks with military commanders. Gates says he sees the American combat role in Iraq shrinking more in the months to come. And the day started well in Harare, Zimbabwe. Bitter political rivals President Robert Mugabe and the opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai signed a historic power-sharing deal.
I invite the signatories of the agreement to exchange the documents now.
So This is the part where the two men then stand up. They're smiling broadly. They shake hands. They sign on the deal. Then the crowd goes wild. We hear some ululating in the crowd, of course. But it seems that the political accord has not reached all supporters. We're getting reports now that are saying that thousands of protesters have descended on the convention centre where the deal was signed, where President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai have already given out their speeches, said how pleased they are to be working together. Supporters of the two men are throwing stones at one another, and police have fired warning shots. But Arthur Mutambara, the new deputy prime minister and leader of one of the opposition parties, said that the compromise agreement was a victory for Zimbabwe.
This is a victory of Zimbabweans saying to each other, there's more that brings us together than that which divides us.
So now the real hard work begins. President Mugabe keeps his position as president. He's in charge of the army. Mr. Tsvangirai becomes prime minister. He's in charge of the police. Adora, John.
Thanks very much, Femi. We'll certainly be watching to see how that works. See if it works well at all. And of course, today people are going to be looking to Wall Street to see reaction to some earth-shattering events over the weekend. Some calling it historic. First of all, you're talking about Lehman Brothers, the fourth largest investment company in the country with 26,000 employees, will file bankruptcy. And also news that Bank of America has made a deal to buy another troubled investment bank, and that's Merrill Lynch. Meanwhile, as those two deals are taking place, AIG, the world's largest insurance company, is looking to the Federal Reserve for a multi-billion dollar bailout. Matthew Bishop is following all of this. He's the chief business writer for The Economist. Good morning, Matthew. And is an earthquake on Wall Street, is that too strong of a word?
No, I mean, maybe understating it, actually. I mean, it's I think, the biggest, most difficult weekend that Wall Street has ever had to endure, certainly since the 1929 crash. So it's a big deal.
So the Lehman's brother filing for bankruptcy is not necessarily a big shock. The two surprises here may be Merrill Lynch and Bank of America and concerns about AIG. Let's start with Bank of America.
Well, I mean, actually, the Lehman brother filing for bankruptcy is a shock. I think most people felt that a buyer would be found for Lehman Brothers over the weekend.
But this is a process, Matthew, that's been going on for weeks now. They've been looking for someone to come in and rescue them.
The presumption has been that the government, having already bailed out Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, would come to the rescue again because it would be too catastrophic to contemplate a bankruptcy of a major firm like Lehman Brothers in this fragile financial market, in this fragile economy. And so the government is taking a big risk, a big step into the unknown by not coming to the rescue. And I think a lot of the Wall Street firms who gathered over the weekend had expected that ultimately, at the back of their minds, that the government would come forward and rescue Lehman as well.
So what do you make of that shift then here of the Fed not stepping in?
Well, I think it's a high-risk moment. I think the Treasury Secretary early last week, after he was criticized for bailing out Fannie and Freddie, went around the Wall Street banks, according to the Wall Street Journal, and told them that he wasn't going to bail out anyone else. And so that may have actually precipitated the crisis in a way by bringing things to a head this weekend. So where we go now is a big leap into the unknown. Clearly, Merrill being bought. Merrill would have been the next firm that everyone turned their attention to after Lehman Brothers. The question is, who is it now? It's maybe AIG is already in trouble, but what about Goldman Sachs? Might they even be sucked into all this? Because they're very similar in their structure.
Well, they're also
to Lehman Brothers.
There's talk about J.P. Morgan, certainly Washington Mutual. It's another bank with all kinds of problems. Let's just take a look over in Europe. Markets falling 4% or more across the board over there. I'm wondering if it's harder to value a bank in London today based on what happened over the weekend here in the United States.
Yes, I think it's harder to value everything at the moment as an outside investor, indeed even inside the system. And I think until the dust settles, I mean, if we can get through two or three days now and people realize that, you know, Lehman Brothers, the businesses that make up Lehman Brothers, that most of those businesses aren't being shut down and people aren't being forced out onto the streets, out of their offices, but that actually there's an orderly process of figuring out what's profitable and what isn't profitable within Lehman Brothers, then I think markets will be calm again. But if we start getting more alarming TV footage and people being fired in large numbers, then and other banks being sucked into this, then we could see another major move downwards in the markets everywhere.
So in your estimation, it truly is a wait-and-see moment to see how these two deals unfold.
Yes, the government, you know, could have eased things a lot over the weekend. It's decided not to. It may be the right decision not to, but it's a huge step into the unknown, and I think we're going to have a lot of uncertainty, and that means very volatile prices in the markets for everything for the next few days at least, and maybe much longer than that.
Well, we won't have to wait and see about AIG. If they don't get the $40 billion today, a downgrade, which is inevitably going to follow, is going to initiate some contract issues that will cause a mandatory unwinding of AIG that there will be very little for the federal government to do anything about. How do we watch that, Matthew?
Well, I think we watch with our fingers crossed and hope that it manages to sort to convince the market with this restructuring package it has, because again, the knock-on effects of AIG being unwound, you know, are very, very hard to imagine, and you know, could have consequences all over the place.
So it's sounding like it's a potentially disastrous, but certainly going to be a very stressful day for not only market watchers, but those who work for Merrill Lynch or Lehman Brothers.
It's certainly going to be stressful. You know, I certainly wouldn't want to be at Lehman Brothers at the moment. I think we are. I mean, I think the fact that the government decided not to bail out Lehman Brothers must mean that it's had some indication from the other Wall Street titans that they think they can weather this storm and that they can have an orderly unwinding of Lehman Brothers, but we will see, and I think a lot of people are skeptical about that. So I think there's just going to be an enormous amount of nervousness and stress. But it may mark the bottom. I mean, it may be the darkest hour before the dawn. This is the nature of the uncertainty we're in at the moment.
Matthew Bishop, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Matthew Bishop is the chief business writer for The Economist, weighing in on all of the developments
both here in
the U.S. and overseas, and the markets responding to what's happening here in Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch.
Hearing a kind of silver lining in what he was saying there, that if the Fed has walked away from Lehman, it must mean that other banks have assured the Fed that they're in decent shape. There's lots of ways to catch up with us at the Takeaway.
Yeah, we've certainly heard that a couple of times this morning, people saying that perhaps that this is just an efficient shedding of what was too many people doing the same things.
Well, efficient, inefficient, what do we do? Do you bail something out or do you let them fail? Lehman is falling. Should the government bail these companies out?
Good morning. This is Wendy from Atlantic City, New Jersey. I don't think the United States should bail anyone out. They're used to bailing out farmers and they're used to bailing out big companies, but they don't bail out the regular Americans.
Thanks for that, Wendy. And you want Junior, we're going to ask you to eat her vegetables, but all she wants is chocolate cereals. What are your tips and tricks for getting your kids or children to eat healthy foods?
Hi there. My name is Mary Ellen. I'm from Brooklyn. And the way to get kids to eat challenging foods is if they help you cook it, they're more likely to eat it. Okay, bye.
I think you would agree with that, John.
Absolutely. And, you know, and it's easy to cook vegetables, actually. It's actually pretty easy to make decent vegetables. Give us your take at 877-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Strategies for eating challenging foods. I love that euphemism. And when do we bail out and when do we let them fail?
I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
In times of financial insecurity and economic adversity,
we'll be there with the strength and resources you can count on. Because at Merrill Lynch, we're bullish on the future.
Right. Fresh out of future, Merrill Lynch looks to a buyer while Lehman Brothers looks to bankruptcy court. AIG and Washington Mutual, what about them? It's not pretty. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Huckenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, September 5th. 15th, I should say. Good morning, John.
Good morning and welcome back, Adora.
And I saw you shudder when I said September 5th. Anyhow, today, as you've noted, a massive shakeup on Wall Street over the weekend, making for turmoil on the markets here and abroad. We'll take a look at that. And also the effects of Hurricane Ike are still far-reaching. More than 2 million people are without power, and it might stay that way for days. Picky eaters. Do you have picky eaters in your household? Perhaps your children. We'll talk about some common mistakes you as a parent might be making. Help is on the way. Those stories are coming up, but first these headlines.
Broccoli is on the way. On Wall Street, it's reeling from the news of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. The finance giant announced early this morning it is filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The company has lost billions in the subprime crisis, and stocks across the globe tumbled on the announcement. European markets are down a staggering 4% or more. More from Wall Street. Bank of America is taking over investment titan Merrill Lynch in a $50 billion deal. Merrill Lynch, the world's biggest brokerage firm, has been also suffering huge losses in the credit crunch. And AIG, the world's largest insurance company, is on the lookout for some extra cash. It's not pocket change, $40 billion worth to be exact. AIG is trying to find emergency funding to stay afloat.
Hurricane Ike may be over, but residents all over the country are suffering in the aftermath. More than 2 million people in Texas, Arkansas, and Louisiana are without power this morning. Disastrous flooding has forced evacuations as far north as Chicago. Ike is being blamed for 30 deaths. It's an historic day in Zimbabwe. Just hours ago, President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai signed a power-sharing deal. Tsvangirai will be the new prime minister. He says he signed the deal because it's the country's best hope moving forward.
I have signed this agreement because my belief in Zimbabwe and its peoples runs deeper than the scars I bear from the struggle.
In the aftermath of the signing of the sharing agreement, the power sharing agreement, police have been firing warning shots. That's been reported at crowds converging on the meeting. Supporters of both rival Morgan Tsvangirai and the ruling party leader Robert Mugabe.
In U.S. politics, Barack Obama is going to be in Colorado today, and John McCain is campaigning in Florida. Oil prices, we should note, another important market trend, dropped below $96 a barrel. As we pointed out, the S&P is down nearly 50 points before the markets open. At least the futures contract closed Friday on 1251, will probably open lower than 1200 today. So you want your kids to eat their vegetables, but all they want is chocolate cereal. What are your tips and tricks for getting your kids to eat something beside Cocoa Puffs? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Also, when do we bail out and when do we let fail? All on the show today.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. This morning, many are still dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Ike. Hundreds have been rescued from the flooding. Millions have been without electricity and may not get it back for some time. Ike tore through Texas, and on Friday, we spoke with Paul Pennegraft, a senior producer for news and public affairs at KUHF, Houston Public Radio. And we go back to him now in Houston. Good morning, Paul. And like many, you have no electricity. How are you coping?
Well, I've been basically living here at the radio station. I went to my house last night for the first time and just to kind of see if it's okay. And it turns out that it's all right. Structurally, it seems it's okay. No power. I lost some large tree limbs. I lost a fence. But it seems that, you know, it certainly could have been worse. And there are many others who clearly have greater challenges than I. I have a place to sleep under my desk. It's not very exciting. I actually moved into one of the talk studios last night and slept on an air mattress. But we do have backup power here. We're on the air, and we're fine here at the radio station.
Like you said, there are certainly some people who have it far worse off.
Please.
I mean, 5 million people are without power. At least that's what the Chronicle is reporting this morning. And 2,000 people were rescued from their flooded neighborhoods?
Yeah, that's, most of the trouble was on the actual on Galveston Island. That's the worst of the worst. Galveston Island and the other peninsula called Bolivar Peninsula, those are the barrier islands right off the coast, and those sustained just terrible, I mean, horrific damage. Some of these houses are just, they look like they've been blown up. And there was a mandatory evacuation, but it was a mandatory evacuation with a wink, which means that you need to leave. We want you to leave. If you don't leave, you're not going to get any help. Well, about 20,000 people who live on Galveston Island decided to stay, and many of them on the West End, which is the worst of the worst. And there were rescues, and there were, much like what we saw in Katrina, the Coast Guard came in with their helicopters, and they were retrieving people. But here's, if there is good news in this, and this is a qualified with an asterisk, they've, as of this morning, I've only been aware of three deaths that occurred on Galveston Island as a result of the storm, and none in Houston. There may be a few, we're hearing little indications that there may be some deaths over on Bolivar Peninsula, which is across the bay.
Mm-hmm.
But this is certainly, it could have been so much worse. But there's property damage that's going to be in the tens of billions of dollars, maybe 30, maybe $50 billion worth of damage from the storm.
But let's get back to the immediacy of the electricity. Millions still without power. And what are you being told in terms of how long it will take? Because there are certainly ramifications for that with the heat. It's hot and no electricity means no oil rigs are going to get up and going, electricity for hospital, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, the first, they prioritized and got all the hospitals back first. All of the assisted living centers with elderly citizens, most of those are back on. They started working from the western part of the county, western part of the region, towards the east. And as of last night, or the word we've got this morning is that about a quarter of the folks who were without power have been restored. It's a random average of 1 in 4 have been restored. But that still means that there's 75% of this region that's out of power, and that's in the millions easily. And they're telling us that in the coming 2 or 3 days, they'll be able to restore a significant number every day. But there will be the random neighborhood, the random house, the random building that may take up to 4 weeks, we're being told. And on Galveston Island and the areas where it's the worst, it may take more than that.
And what can you see? What have you been able to tell us what you've been able to see as you've gone through the city and the area?
I have driven a good bit about the city and the region, and it's the closer to the coast you get, obviously the more structural damage with the buildings you see. But in Houston proper, there are thousands of downed trees and giant limbs, and that's the root cause for all of the electricity problems is the trees have knocked power lines down. And there are still thousands of trees that cross streets, so there's a traffic issue, and navigating through the city is a real challenge because of that. Work is underway to remove that, but that's what you see most of the time. There are roofs that are peeled back. There are shingles that are missing. There are chimneys with no caps. And even in the downtown, the Central Business District, folks who are familiar with the Central Business District, our Chase Tower, which is our tallest building in the downtown area, has hundreds of windows that were blown out, and it really is reminiscent of other storms in the past where literally windows up in 50 and 60 and 70 stories were blown out. So
a bit of irony for what's going on Wall Street today too, Paul.
Well, yeah, that may
there
be
we
a
go.
Metaphor. Yeah,
yeah.
We should.
Paul Penegraph, thank you.
Thank you, my friends, and good luck to you.
Paul Penegraph is a senior producer for news and public affairs at KUHF Houston Public Radio, where he is currently sleeping. under his desk or in the studios at night.
Well, on Wall Street today, they're probably just wishing it was blown out windows. No, it's much worse than that. The markets on Wall Street are scheduled to open in a little over 15 minutes' time. As we've reported, Lehman Brothers is bankrupt. Bank of America is buying Merrill Lynch, the largest brokerage firm in the world. And AIG, the largest insurance company in the world, is being, is looking for a $40 billion loan. And if it doesn't get it, we could see more unwinding today. All of this has the markets poised to open seriously lower. Joining us now is Eric Dash, a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Eric, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, I sort of listed the headlines there, but there's a fascinating piece that you and your colleagues have written on the New York Times website, which sort of describes what appears to be the case now. On Wall Street, you don't work during the week. Only on the weekends do you work. You describe what exactly happened to precipitate the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. As we go into Monday's trading, what do you think the most important thing is to watch?
I think it will be to watch what happens to AIG. I think that really is the key point to focus on right now.
And that could actually unwind completely today. I mean, unlike what happened to Lehman Brothers, which really took a whole, week to unfold, as you report.
Right. Well, AIG has a serious capital shortfall, but they also have very high-quality businesses, which they are trying to sell. But the part of the problem is that people know that they have businesses that they need to sell, and people aren't willing to lend them money. So that they've asked now the Fed to be able to borrow from it, so that it can so that they can work out some sort of sales arrangement. And we'll see if the Fed accepts their request.
Well, they walked away from Lehman Brothers, so really it's a mystery as to what the Fed will do today. In looking at your report on what happened over the weekend, one of the things that's really interesting here is just how interrelated all of these banks are in absorbing this misery of the subprime crisis. It seems that Bank of America was actually a player for Lehman Brothers until it backed out on Sunday. And wow, we learned they were going to buy Merrill Lynch perhaps all along. And I'm wondering if Merrill Lynch saw an opportunity to just sort of get out of this and dodge a bullet as the blood was sort of spreading from Lehman Brothers.
I think that's true. And I also think that Ken Lewis is one heck of a poker player, especially on the global banking stage. You know, he looked at the assets of Lehman Brothers. He was looking and was very interested in buying the whole company, but he also needed to reassure his shareholders that they could handle the deal, and he wasn't going to do a deal without government support. Meanwhile, he was also talking to Merrill Lynch, so he had options. And he didn't play his hand until the final moments of the weekend.
Well, poker player on the case of Fisher, but what about John Thain, who's the head of Merrill Lynch? I mean, a year ago or so, he was running the New York Stock Exchange, if I'm not mistaken. Now he's working for a bank.
And a few months ago, he said, "I'd never sell Merrill." My, how things have changed. Right,
my, how things have changed. Try to explain for people, and we're going to keep you into the next segment, but explain for people why these numbers of the futures matter as the market opens 15 minutes from now.
Well, I think the futures gives you an indication of how things are going to trade today. And if it was Sunday, Bloody Sunday, it could be a Bloody Monday.
And we've got 4% declines in Europe. Do you expect those will be mirrored, at least at the open, in about 15 minutes?
That's probably likely, given where futures are trading right now. And if you know, oil was down about $6 this morning on the belief that there's going to be less global demand, and that's a sign of a global slowdown.
All right. Well, I want to talk about the oil number, because that is really, really very interesting, as you've said. Plus, I want to get a little more deeply into the issues that AIG is facing as we go forward. Eric Dash, New York Times reporter, reporting on the markets opening on Wall Street and the over-the-weekend demise and bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. Eric, stay with us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We're following global markets and the economy this morning. And if to add insult to injury, industrial output, it's just been reported, plunged by the largest amount in 3 years here in the United States as auto production falls sharply. Just one of the numbers that Wall Street is going to be taking a look at as trading begins a little less than 10 minutes from now. Eric Dash joins us. He's a reporter for The New York Times who has an amazing kind of minute-by-minute story of what happened over the weekend, this historic weekend, which resulted in the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, the fourth largest investment bank in the United States, and the acquisition by Bank of America of Merrill Lynch. There's also a story of AIG that we were talking about a moment ago. Eric, thanks for staying with us. You mentioned oil prices declining before we went into the break, and I don't want to talk about the crazy commodity markets per se, but oil declining in the midst of all of this is really a sobering indication of a deepening recession worldwide. Why is that the case?
Well, I think part of the problem is the financial sector itself. Companies depend on banks to lend. And with the credit crisis, banks have suffered major, massive losses, and they've frozen their lending. And if they can't get access to money, businesses can't invest, and the economy then has to slow down. And so I think that's what we're seeing with oil prices and the industry output numbers today.
You know, in a traditional industry like, I mean, traditional, what am I saying? But in, say, the auto industry or a widget maker or something, the company goes bankrupt and, you know, they've got a lot of cars and you just sort of sell them in a kind of a fire sale. When a bank declares bankruptcy, what is it? A bankrupt bank? I mean, what is that even?
Well, I think it's a bank that is unable to obtain funding and therefore, you know, has to start selling things. And because the system is so interconnected, that impacts all the other banks. So as somebody put it to me yesterday, everybody on Sunday was at work yesterday if they lived in New York. They were at work if their company was blowing up because they had to unwind their positions. And or if their company wasn't blowing up because they were unwinding their positions because they had exposure to Lehman, and they were at work if their company was blowing up because they were gathering their belongings.
I mean, I don't want to leave the impression that I'm starting a 1-800 number for investment bankers, but, I mean, really, you do have to feel for people who report to work today at Lehman Brothers. Are they even getting paid?
I don't think that they know that, and I think the uncertainty is just killing them right now. I think that it's unlikely that they're going to get any severance. It's unlikely that they're going to get health care benefits. So they're going to have to suffer along with the rest of us now.
And, Eric, let's just go back to what you report in your article about the meetings that really began on Friday night all through the weekend of not only the Lehman and the Fed, Lehman officials and Fed officials, but also titans from all of the investment banking companies. What were they told by the Feds about what needs to happen in the eyes of this crisis?
Well, Federal Reserve Bank of New York President Tim Geithner convened all the heads of the Wall Street banks because he wanted to send a personal message telling him that they urgently needed an industry solution and that the government, which had helped with the rescue of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac last weekend or the week, and J.P. Morgan's takeover of Bear Stearns in March, that the government was no longer going to step in, that taxpayer money was no longer going to be on the line, and if the banks thought that the government was going to help them, they were just barking up the wrong path.
And what was the response by the leaders of these companies, many of whom, especially at Lehman, arguably thought perhaps the Fed would step in at the last moment to help them out?
Well, they did, and they also felt that, look, Lehman Brothers plunged into risky businesses like subprime mortgage packaging and took risky trading positions to make profits. And why should they, at a time when they were suffering from their own losses, be putting up their own money to bail Lehman Brothers out. They said, look, government, this is your responsibility. And so what you had was just a giant game of chicken and a standoff between the Federal Reserve and the Wall Street banks. And from the Federal Reserve's point of view, they were very worried about this idea of moral hazard.
Well, if this is a game of chicken, if you're someone who used to work for Bear Stearns and are employed today, you're feeling like chicken cordon bleu for being the first one to go out, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I guess that's the lesson here. If you're going to go down, be the first one to go down because you'll get the federal bailout. I mean, J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs and even Washington Mutual are supposedly up next. You allude to that in your column. How do we watch these institutions?
Well, look, you never know about which bank is next, and I think it's dangerous to get in the business of speculating. But I think I think that you just have to closely monitor the situation.
And that's exactly what we're doing this morning. Eric Dash, thanks so much for being with us.
Great. Thank you.
Eric Dash, a New York Times reporter. His minute-by-minute story, which he wrote with a number of his colleagues, is on the New York Times website. And, of course, the Times is our content partner. Wow. No severance. No health benefits. We don't know that, but that's his speculation.
Yeah, there. And you're talking about 26,000 workers for Lehman. And then on the Merrill Lynch side, you've got another, I think, 50, 60,000 employees that Merrill Lynch employees, so we have to see what Bank of America does in that instance. But right now, we're going to turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines for us.
Thanks very much, Adore. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Very jittery Wall Street is set to open any moment now. The fallout from Lehman Brothers bankruptcy filing is already rocking the markets. Futures plunged on the news from the investment giant. Global markets are tanking. And in European trading, markets plummeted by 4%. New numbers from the Federal Reserve. It's reporting that industrial output dropped 1.1% last month. That's four times the amount that was expected. It's the worst performance since Hurricane Katrina devastated the Gulf Coast back in 2005. And poor auto production fueled the drop. Auto production is down almost 12%. Fresh reports from Houston this hour. Floodwaters are receding, but about 4 million people are still without power in the city. Trucks loaded with emergency supplies are starting to get through, bringing ice, water and food to distribution centres. And around 2,000 people have been rescued in the area so far. Pakistani troops have fired shots at U.S. military helicopters today. The U.S. forces crossed the border into Pakistan from neighboring Afghanistan this morning.
This is a really disturbing story. The U.S. forces actually crossed into Pakistan.
Yes.
And that's according to Pakistani reports or?
This is from the news we're getting from the Associated Press
so far.
And the reason you're drawing attention to it was because last week Pakistan said no more troops are allowed to come in, even if they're on raids, even if they're pursuing Taliban, into our country.
And
we will
so
protect our borders.
The tension here, and of course, with a brand new prime minister, brand new president of Pakistan, brand new government over there. So this seems to be escalating.
It is so far. But if you listen to the news very carefully, we get these raids every single day almost. So it's just business as usual as far as the U.S. troops are concerned.
Very hard to sort out. Thank you for helping us, Femi.
Oh, I tried.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, which asks, is there an age when people should no longer be held accountable for their actions? Can someone be too old to be responsible? Or is that ageism? Opinions shared at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I invite the signatories of the agreement to exchange the documents now.
That was a response to an historic day in Zimbabwe as two bitter political rivals come to a compromise. President Robert Mugabe and the opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai were sitting at a table, and they signed a power-sharing deal aimed at resolving the country's political and economic crisis that's been going on for months now. The two men smiled and shook hands. Under the deal, Robert Mugabe remains president while Mr. Tsvangirai becomes prime minister with substantial powers. Adam Minot is a correspondent with the BBC in Johannesburg. He joins us now. Thanks for being with us, Adam.
Pleasure.
So, what does this deal mean exactly? What is a prime minister with substantial powers?
We don't yet know the full details surrounding this deal, but what it does look like is an approximately 50-50 split in executive authority. You've got, as you said, Robert Mugabe remaining president and head of state, and he will head a cabinet made up of 31 ministers. And at the same time, you've got a prime minister who will head another cabinet committee made up of the same members. So there is still a bit of confusion as to exactly how this power-sharing agreement will take place. It's taken 2 months to get here, 2 months of negotiations that were on again, off again, very nearly collapsed in ruins. And this, of course, follows the disputed election that took place back in March. So I think you're right. I think this is going to be a historic day, almost whatever happens. There are still some sceptics who believe that it is possible that full power sharing will not take place and that President Mugabe will retain the grip on power that he's held for the past 28 years.
Adam, that brings me to a question about the tipping point here. Given the context for which you've just outlined that this power-sharing agreement has come to fruition, what was it that finally forced Mugabe to agree, at least on paper, to sharing a government that he's ruled for nearly 30 years?
I mean, I think there were a number of factors, probably not just one. I think there were several things that played into this. There was certainly the intervention of the South African president, Thabo Mbeki, who's been leading the negotiations. I think his influence was undoubtedly strong. I think another key factor was the continuing collapse of the Zimbabwean economy, where inflation is now estimated to be running at an astonishing 20,000,000% annually. Now, that renders the economy and the financial system in Zimbabwe almost completely meaningless and without power. So I think that was certainly a key factor, and I think possibly a recognition by Robert Mugabe that his chances really of clinging on to power in the face of a growing opposition were simply impossible.
And his rival, Tsvangirai, has certainly been a potent opposition force. Let's listen to what Tsvangirai says is the reason that he agreed to this power-sharing split.
I have signed this agreement because I believe it represents the best opportunity for us to build a peaceful, prosperous, democratic Zimbabwe. I have signed this agreement because my belief in Zimbabwe and its peoples runs deeper than the scars I bear from the struggle. I have signed this agreement because my hope for the future is stronger than the grief I feel for the needless suffering of the past years.
And Adam, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that in there is an implicit reference to the fact that some in his party, the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, were not happy with the deal as outlined, this 50-50 share out of power. Some have accused the MDC of backing down under pressure. But I think what Morgan Tsvangirai was trying to say there was this was simply the best deal available on offer, and he simply couldn't have done better. And I think what is key now is to see how the power sharing unfolds in the course of the coming days, weeks, possibly even months, because we've got two very powerful men at the head of their separate power blocks, and really it's how these men are able to wield executive power under a changing situation and how quickly they can move towards a new constitution and new elections sometime after 18 months.
Adam Minot, thank you. He's a BBC correspondent in Johannesburg. And the Associated Press is reporting this morning that after the power-sharing agreement was signed, several hundred people broke through the great gates into the grounds of the convention center where it was taking place, and that, in fact, police even had to fire warning shots and use riot dogs but failed to contain the crowd. So certainly some unrest there following the signing of that power-sharing agreement. We'll keep an eye on that story. And now we're going to go to Femi Okeh for the other stories.
Well, hold on. We're going to go check the markets here just for a moment. We are open on Wall Street, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 100 points. The S&P down about 17. It's bad, but it's perhaps not as bad as was expected. Of course, the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers precipitating this. Also, the acquisition by Bank of America of Merrill Lynch. And we asked about bailouts. When are they appropriate and when are they not? And the question of what is a bailout and what is a takeover was very much on your mind.
I am Rich Jaffe calling from New York City. There's a difference between a bailout and a takeover. Fannie Mae is not being bailed out. It's being taken over. The company is its stockholders, and the stockholders are essentially being wiped out.
All right. If you want to either bring us up to date on what's going on in the markets or give us an economics lesson, we love it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now some headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks very much, John. As you just said, Lehman Brothers filing for bankruptcy after it failed to find a buyer. Bank of America has agreed to buy Merrill Lynch for about $50 billion. And the insurance company AIG is asking the Fed for emergency funding of around $40 billion. Now, in the wake of these historic shakeups to some of the world's biggest financial institutions, a consortium of international private sector banks and security firms has announced a new $70 billion loan fund. The money can be used by financial companies to help ease the credit shortage. And the Fed is also making moves to ease access to emergency credit for struggling financial companies. The upset in the U.S. markets is affecting trading all over the world today. Share prices tumbled in European and Asian trading, and the key market index in Taiwan dropped by more than 4%. And in Zimbabwe, 7 weeks of tough negotiations led to President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai signing an historic power-sharing deal in Harare this morning. So President Mugabe gets to keep his presidential post and Morgan Tsvangirai becomes prime minister. He will be in charge of the police and President Mugabe will also be in charge of the army. We will see how this power-sharing agreement works
Since you've been talking, Femi, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is now down 300 points. So maybe you should...
Should I stop talking?
Maybe you should stop talking. Yeah, I know you have some more news, but I just wanted to update you there.
Maybe the tone of the news should change. How about this? The Simpsons are celebrating. They have won their 10th Creative Arts Emmy Award. The Creative Arts Emmys were held in Los Angeles this weekend, and it honors categories like makeup, costumes, sound editing. The Primetime Emmys will be next weekend. That's September the 21st. They would all be together, except that it would take far too long. So congratulations to The Simpsons.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is the takeover. This is the takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
The takeover.
The takeover. It could be the takeover today. Peter Morici joins us. He's professor at the University of Maryland College of Business and Management and former chief economist with the U.S. International Trade Commission. Given what the markets are doing today, it seems like you were right. You wrote over the weekend that Lehman Brothers is toxic at any price. Well, now it's bankrupt, Peter.
That's right. It essentially has a negative net worth. The liabilities owing to the bad real estate investments and the mortgage-backed securities exceed the value of Neuberger Berman and its investment management unit, and its investment banking facility in the hands of its present management is absolutely worthless.
And so where do we go from here? The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 320 points. I mean, on some level, that's an expected consequence of what the futures were doing this morning. But what's the place to watch for what's next on the trading floor today?
Well, I'd look very closely at Citigroup stock. How much does it fall? I mean, we expect there to be trouble with WaMu and with AIG, but Citigroup becomes the bellwether because all of the New York banks are infected with the same kinds of problems as Lehman Brothers, toxic securities and management practices that are highly questionable and have not been reformed over the last year. So, you know, how does the market evaluate the process? So we know that AIG and Merrill are next, but is Citigroup come under assault after that?
And I guess the issue there really is Citigroup, unlike some of these others, is a big component of a lot of these international stock portfolios. So whether Citigroup, it in some sense, is probably a hint of the broader confidence in the U.S. economy.
Well, no, I think it's a mistake to say that these financial firms are the U.S. economy. The rest of the economy is showing great signs of good management and life, and it's really the financials in New York that have been holding us all back because they've gotten themselves into trouble and they haven't been willing to do what's necessary to get out of trouble. At some point, Vikram Pandit may be asked to leave because he's just not making the changes in that bank that are necessary.
He's the CEO of Citigroup.
Right. I mean, he's the guy who took $155 million and put it in his pocket, selling them a bad hedge fund. He doesn't seem to be inclined to change the kinds of management practices that reward 35-year-old MBAs with salaries of $10 and $20 million a year. He thinks that he's employing a whole stable of Derek Jeters and that he is then entitled to many multiples of that.
Well, you speak a lot about the pay scale and how much that has precipitated this particular crisis. But I'm wondering, can the consumer in America sort of sitting off on Main Street really feel as though this isn't going to affect the broad economy of the United States?
Well, the reality is it's already affected the broad economy of the United States in that there's a shortage of conventional financing. There's a shortage of lease financing for cars, conventional mortgages, business loans, and so forth, because these guys have exited the commercial banking business in search of greener pastures. We may need to go through this process of bankrupting several of the large firms, seeing them busted apart, and having regional banks take their place.
Well, that's certainly what the Fed is betting at this point. Their strategy actually looks like. We're going to pause for just a second. Let me note that on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has slipped below a drop of $300. It's a 282 down, which is bad, but perhaps not as bad as was anticipated this morning. We'll be right back with Peter Morici.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Continuing now with watching Wall Street working its way through a very, very difficult day after an historic weekend where Lehman Brothers declares bankruptcy and Merrill Lynch is acquired by Bank of America. And as we were just speaking with Peter Morici at the University of Maryland College of Business and Management, AIG is a stock to watch. Also, Citigroup, something to watch, and Washington Mutual, all stocks under pressure on Wall Street today. Also joining us is Jeremy Batstone Carr, who's an analyst with Charles Stanley Stockbrokers in London. Jeremy, thank you for coming back with us.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Peter, we were just talking before the break about how much this has already affected the Main Street economy by restricting the amount of financing. What's that going to mean for the next 12 months and particularly the next month of the political campaign? What's the takeaway for people looking for what this is going to mean for broad American taxpayers?
Well, one of the takeaways is that Barack Obama is being advised by some questionable people. Bob Rubin is at the center of this, and he picked Jason Furman, his principal economic advisor. The Fed and the Treasury until now have gone pretty soft on Wall Street. This is the first tough love they've given them. They've opened the discount window wide, and there's been a lot of pressure from the Congress to be accommodating. You hear the Congress screaming and yelling about oil company profits, but you don't hear them screaming and yelling about these big salaries on Wall Street in quite the same way and the problems on Wall Street, because frankly the Democrats in Congress and Obama are raising a lot of money on Wall Street, or have been until yesterday, it'll be interesting to see whether McCain plays that card, because Wall Street is really a Democratic street.
That's interesting. Jeremy Batstone Carr, what is the markets outside of the United States, what are they waiting to see from the Fed? Do they want something of a tough love approach where they let Lehman Brothers fail and a sign that, you know, we've drawn a line in the sand, we're not going forward? Or are they going to be reassured by a continuing set of bailouts here, Jeremy?
Well, I think that financial markets around the world want actually is the creation of some form of publicly financed vehicle into which distressed banking assets can fall. This is not the time to be worrying about moral hazard. Moral hazard is pro-cyclical, should have been addressed when the credit bubble was being inflated, not when it's deflating. That's the first thing the markets want. The second thing that the markets want is aggressive cuts in short-term interest rates. You couldn't cut U.S. base rates to 1% in 2003 during a period in which the bubble was inflating. But by goodness, you can in 2008 when the bubble is deflating. Indeed, you could go to naught if necessary. I think we'll see a cut in the U.S. interest rates. If we don't see it now, then we'll get an emergency 50 basis point cut before too very long. I think we'll see the Bank of England, the European Central Bank follow suit, irrespective of their concerns over inflation.
Peter, what do you make of that proposal from Jeremy that there would be some sort of internationally supervised place for distressed securities to go and either be resold or, I guess, die?
I don't think that's on. I don't think the United States government is going to let the Wall Street banks off the hook after the mess they've made. I think it's going to let them wind down. As for an interest rate cut, it wouldn't do much good. The federal funds rate and the rates charged on mortgages and business loans have effectively decoupled other than the prime rate because the New York banks are no longer securitizing mortgage loans into bonds. They've essentially exited the securitization process of commercial banking. So right now, the linkage between monetary policy and the interest rates that consumers pay and mortgages and things of this nature is broken. And
that's a huge story. So you're saying that what we've had over the last 2 years, where T-bills have been tied to interest rates or general commercial interest rates, that's broken and it's off by itself?
Mortgage rates have gone up, and the federal funds rate has come down. Hmm. So the federal funds rate is what you play with when you make monetary policy. So what I'm saying is that it's not the T-bill rate that matters; it's the mortgage rate that matters. The business loan rate. You can't get leasing financing at any price right now. One of the reasons the big three are in Washington begging for money is because they can't borrow it anymore, and they're not alone in that conundrum. Maybe the big three don't deserve to be able to borrow any money, but a lot of businesses can't even borrow it at any price. So it's really monetary policy is not functioning right now.
All right, well, let me get a comment from Jeremy. You say that the world would be very concerned if there's sort of an open kind of knives on Wall Street kind of vengeful sentiment on Wall Street for all that sort of thing. But what do you think of the issue of the dollar and the fact that oil is dropping right now? Are those positives going forward?
I think that the oil price fall is a positive, unquestionably. A lot of companies find that energy costs are a major part of their overall cost base, so that has got to be a positive. The dollar's weakness may prove temporary. I think that the dollar will recover its poise, will probably gain quite strongly on the foreign exchanges over the remainder of this year. That, of course, brings with it the potential for negative translation of overseas profits or overseas revenue, should I say, into the dollar. I want to come back on what your other guest said, though, because I haven't heard what he's actually proposing. At least what I've come up with actually represents a hard and fast proposal to rescue the funding markets, which I completely agree is where the crisis is. If the funding markets don't work, then this is going to go on. It's going to claim bigger victims.
Peter, quick response, and then we got to go.
Well, I think the Fed needs to wedge Citigroup and others to start providing the linkage and essentially securitizing consumer loans and mortgages and business loans into bonds, plain vanilla bonds that investors can understand so that the economy can get going again. That's the liquidity crisis.
Peter Marici, professor at the University of Maryland College of Business, and Jeremy Batstone Carr, analyst with Charles Stanley Stockbrokers in London. Both of you watching the markets this morning and the broader implications for the economy. Thanks to both of you. A fascinating discussion. Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average down 300 points. We're going to give it to Femi Oke for the last word today.
Hi there, John. The time is coming up to 5 minutes to the top of the hour. Lehman Brothers Bank is filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, while the Bank of America is snapping up Merrill Lynch in a $50 billion all-stock transaction. American International Group, Inc. is also restructuring, and a global consortium of banks working with government officials in New York announced a $70 billion pool of funds to lend help to troubled financial companies. Cleanup continues today in the wake of Hurricane Ike. The storm slammed into Texas, cutting power across the central U.S. More than 2 million people remain without power. Indiana and Chicago are facing severe flooding. Hurricane Ike didn't do widespread damage to oil facilities in the Gulf of Mexico, and the price of oil has dipped again today. It dropped below $96 a barrel in trading in Singapore. In Baghdad, a dozen civilians were killed by car bombs today as Defense Secretary Robert Gates arrived in the country for talks with military commanders. Gates says that he sees the American combat role in Iraq shrinking more in the months to come. And finally...
Uh-oh.
Have I scared you yet?
Uh-oh.
A little bit of shark history has passed away. Legendary shark hunter Frank Mundus has died. Mundus is thought to have been the inspiration for Captain Quint in the film Jaws.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
If you like?
Oh,
Frank Mundus hated the character of Captain Quint. He said he hated fact fiction, and Mundus called Jaws the funniest and stupidest movie he had ever seen. But if you look up Frank Mundus, he is so much larger than life than Captain Quint. And he catches monster sharks.
I thought Captain Ahab was the inspiration.
No.
And it was a great lines that Captain Quint had in Jaws. Farewell and adieu to ye fair Spanish ladies. Remember? And you the story of the Indianapolis?
Take me back to my childhood.
John, we don't remember that. Thank you very
Indianapolis.
Much, Femi.
Can you do the whole script of Jaws?
I can do the whole script of Jaws.
Shame that we don't have time. Frank Mundus died of a heart attack.
It's really not a shame, actually.
Yeah, all right, fine, John. Okay.
We have the music.
I want to remind everybody that there's lots of ways that you can catch up with us here at The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, Facebook. Clearly, some grim economic news this morning, and we'll continue to follow that developing story. The news that Lehman Brothers, the investment bank, is faltering has shaken up markets across the world and here at home. And here's your takeaway, or at least a thought.
I think it's a mistake to say that these financial firms are the U.S. economy.
That was Peter Morici, professor at the University of Maryland College of Business and Management and former chief economist with the U.S. International Trade Commission.
He was part of a very lively discussion on what is the takeaway of the volatility that we're seeing on Wall Street every day now. Here's the question. Should these big companies be bailed out? Should they be taken over? Has anyone ever bailed you out or not bailed you out? Have you ever been allowed to fail and it helped you in some way? Give us your take at 877-8MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
And the Dow is down 326 points in trading. It's been open the market 28 minutes.
S&P may actually go below 1,200 today. That can be very, very important. All right, so the market is poised to react to the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, but it's a whole other day tomorrow. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.